This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Not so long ago, we produced an episode called If Roe v. Wade Goes, What Next? And now, according to the draft Supreme Court opinion that was leaked last week, a majority of the justices want to end federally protected abortion rights altogether. The specific case being argued is known as Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, and it will decide whether Mississippi officials can shut down the state's only remaining abortion provider.
We are standing here on a beautiful Friday outside the Jackson Women's Health Organization. It's funny to think that that all is going to center on this one building, which is like a pretty unremarkable building, except for the fact that it is quite pink. It is like a beautiful pale pink. I believe they call it the Pink House. And yeah, let's go in.
As the case came before the Supreme Court last fall, our reporter Rachel Monroe visited Jackson Women's Health, and she met the director, Shannon Brewer.
Shannon Brewer, she's the clinic director.
So we've been seeing a lot of patients this week. The Louisiana clinics are full, and then of course with Texas, you got the SB8 going on. So literally the same week it came into effect, the very first day, our phones rang from 8 o'clock until we left that day. And it was like Texas people, and they were like on panic mode. They were crying, they were upset, they were going through so much. And normally we see patients 3 days a week. We're now seeing patients 5 and some weeks 6 days a week.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, some weeks, yeah. I have been here, it's gonna be 21 years. And I started out part-time as a sterilization technician. It was like, you know, it's just another job. You know, I'm good. I got me a job. I'm happy, you know. And once I started learning the political aspects of it, it changed to, you know, I'm a part of something that's a little bit deeper than just clocking in every day. So a lot of women really don't know what's going on out here. They don't know about the fight. They don't know that we're dealing with these new laws that they're trying to put in place, and we're fighting all of these laws. They're amazed by it.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, who are the patients who come here?
We serve all types of women. There is no one type of women. Because we're here in Jackson and we're the only facility in Mississippi, you know, we do serve predominantly a lot of African-American women here. A lot of women who, you know, are already struggling, you know, as far as health care and stuff like that. They're already having issues with that. We serve a lot of those women, actually. We really do.
Quick question. Rachel is
The New Yorker.
And they wanted to know if you wanted to talk to them
Yeah, I would prefer to remain anonymous.
Yeah, most of our doctors do.
Yeah.
That's totally fine.
Yeah, I've been coming here to Jackson Women's Health Organization for almost 3 years.
Can you, I guess, maybe talk about some of the, like, security stuff that you have to do, even just that you were, like, trying to figure out today?
Yeah, so for safety purposes, we always use a rental car so that our personal car isn't able to be tracked or located. Just with the history of violence against abortion providers in this country, we try to take every precaution to be as safe as possible. So actually back in March of this year, my identity was somehow made known to the protesters.
Oh, wow.
And then they ended up harassing the clinic where I work. And so that made me stop coming here for a little while. And then I ultimately found a new job. So I'll be leaving Mississippi.
Oh gosh.
But continuing to come here.
Yeah, okay. And what are you thinking about and watching with this Supreme Court case that centers on this clinic? A 15-week ban, like, what is that, I guess, as a medical professional, like, is there any sort of scientific basis to that as a...
Absolutely not.
Standard, okay.
Yeah, it's basically just drawing a line in the sand. In general, first trimester abortions are a little bit safer than second trimester abortions, but all abortions are much safer than carrying a pregnancy to term. So pretending like this is in a woman's best interest is just a farce.
Ma'am, they just want to kill your baby. You got a little woman or a little man that deserves to live.
There's the first patients of the day are starting to leave the clinic. Sort of a hectic vibe here at the Pink House.
Let's pray. For these innocent little children who are having to die at the murderous knife of this abortionist doctor and all of these evil, wicked supporters, Father, Lord Jesus, I pray that you would just open the floodgates of terror in such a way that it would help them see that they are going to die and go to hell if they do not trust you as their Lord and Savior. Lord, that there would be a...
It's like, I'm wondering if I could see the literature that you're handing out to folks. If that's
sure.
Something,
yeah.
But...
yeah. I was just telling John about this campaign that Life Action League, mm-hmm. That's what is 2363?
What is 2363?
It's the average number of babies that are aborted in America every day.
Mm-hmm.
Our thing is, scientifically, I mean, DNA says it's a human being from the very beginning of conception. Now, it might not look like you and me, but it is a human being. I mean, at what point is it okay to abort that? You know, 20 weeks where they've got some hair and eyelashes and mm-hmm. They're totally, everything's working.
Everything's present.
So it's just a matter of, do you believe that it's a human being from the beginning or not?
Mm.
I think, and we do.
And how long have you been coming out here? How long have you been up to this?
I think about 12 years.
Oh gosh, wow.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Are you paying attention to the Mississippi law that's now being heard by the Supreme Court case? Is that, oh, you're smiling at that.
Well, can I say I don't have time to really, I mean, my heart is here. My heart is trying to help women here.
Okay.
I do pray that Roe versus Wade gets overturned. And I would love to see it go back to each individual state. And I think that's where it belongs.
And so what, if this clinic does get shut down because whatever happens in the courts, do you all get to retire or you move on to what's happens
next?
There's
still going to be women to help, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Babies to help. And I would love to see us have like maternity centers spring up where we could minister to these women mind, body, and soul.
I know everybody's outside picketing and wanting me to love your child. I do love the child that I have, but I just don't feel like that I can go on and with the pregnancy. What brought me here are the severe laws in Texas. I had to drive here to be able to make my own decision as a woman.
Oh my gosh.
This clinic is a lifesaver. I am extremely sick. I am not able to function. I'm not able to drink any water. I'm not able to hold any food down. I'm not able to care for my other child. It's just not ideal for me to have another kid.
Did you come here from Texas?
I did. I'm from here. I'm from Mississippi.
Oh, okay.
I just lived there, better opportunities, living a better life with my kid,
yeah.
But yeah. I'm so glad to be able to come home and do this. That's it, and I'm married. It's not like I'm having a kid and my husband doesn't know it's by somebody I'm just randomly having sex with. No, we're both business owners, we're married, and we know the type of life we want to live. We don't want a bunch of kids. I can't handle it, my body can't handle it, and it's a decision we made.
And what impact did the Texas law have on your life?
I couldn't make my own decision. I feel like that's taken away from me. I feel like somebody else is telling me what I should do with my body. And it's not right. It's my body. It's my decision. It's my choice. It's my life. It's my soul if it's going to hell. So I just feel like they don't have the right to do that. Like, especially a man, like, you all have to do nothing. We have to do everything. And you have a decision on what I'm going to do? I think not. So I drove all night. I left at 2:30 in the morning with my 6 3/4-year-old. We drove all night, dropped him off with grandma, and I'm here, and I don't feel bad one bit about it.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
No problem.
Have a good day, everybody. Appreciate
Thank you
letting
all.
Me like
you
come in and bother you.
Do you think there's a chance that you all will have to close?
I don't see us closing, but
yeah,
you know. We don't know. Like I said, this is probably the first time when people ask me about it that I don't have a definite answer because of the fact that it's the Supreme Court and they took it, because I still can't believe it. I usually like, no, we're going to fight this today and we're going to do this. But this time you really don't know what's going to happen.
Are you going to go for the arguments? Are you going to go up there?
Yes, we're going.
And that must be like, if it goes not in your favor, then it's like the case has the name of this clinic.
Yeah.
Does that bother you at all, or is that like?
No, that doesn't bother me. The fact that it has the name of the clinic, because whichever direction it goes in, every pro-choice person in America, they'll know that, you know, we were here and we fought all the way to the end. They will know that we were here.
Yeah.
For them at all times, so I don't have a problem with that at all.
If they rule in a way that's not in your favor, then what happens next?
The next day is we figure out how to help women in whatever way we can. The next step is not to just, you know, we lost. The next step is always, how do we make this work? That's what women do. We figure out how to make something work.
That's Shannon Brewer at the Jackson Women's Health Organization speaking last November. Last week, after the draft opinion from the Supreme Court was made public, Brewer said that the clinic might relocate to New Mexico if abortion in Mississippi is criminalized. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to NetSuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
The new film, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, a great title, is one of the first real surprise hits since we've started going back to the theaters. The film is fun, it's heartfelt, and complicated. And it's in a genre all its own. You could call it a sci-fi martial arts family drama. It's about a Chinese-American woman named Evelyn, and she might be the only person who can save the universe from an omnipotent, interdimensional supervillain.
I'm here because we need your help.
Very busy today. No time to help you.
There's a great evil that has taken root in my world.
I cannot talk now. Unless you can help me with my taxes. What is gross necklaces?
I know you have a lot of things on your mind, but nothing could possibly matter more than this conversation we're having right now concerning the fate of every single world of our infinite multiverse.
Respect for all.
Dear Evelyn, I know you. With every passing moment, you feel you might have missed your chance to make something of your life. I'm here to tell you, every rejection, every disappointment has led you here, to this moment. Don't let anything distract you from it.
It turns out that the supervillain threatening everything is in an alternate universe, Evelyn's teenage daughter, Joy, and Joy's concerns are not exactly science fiction.
The relationship between Evelyn and Joy, in its simplest terms, is very fraught. It is a story of a relationship of a daughter who's a lesbian, who is deeply longing for her mother's acceptance. But they keep chasing each other around in the universe and they can just never find one another until, of course, they launch into the multiverse and become nemeses.
Actress Stephanie Hsu plays both the angst-ridden teenager, Joy, and the interdimensional supervillain named Jobu. She's a veteran of the stage and TV, but this is her first lead role in a film. Stephanie Hsu spoke last week with Gia Tolentino. Gia writes about culture for The New Yorker, and she's the author of the best-selling essay collection, Trick Mirror.
So much about the world seems just extremely overwhelming and bad and broken. You know, every time you look at your phone, you're reminded by nightmare social media of the nightmare situation in Ukraine and the housing crisis and the unending pandemic and just sort of injustice wherever you look, right? And we all feel this all the time. But one of the things that people have responded to so strongly in Everything Everywhere is that the movie seems to sketch out some sort of standpoint about how to live in a world that is overwhelming and bad and broken, right? How to value that world and love that world despite and even because it's that way. And I wonder, how would you describe the movie's perspective on all of that?
Wow, Gia, that was such a beautiful articulation of this moment in time as well as how it relates to our movie. You know, honestly, in some ways, it's been really surreal because we shot this film before the pandemic, mm-hmm. right? We our last day of filming was always set to be it was either March 13th or March 16th, whatever that Friday was that Hollywood shut down. That was always our intended wrap date. And we could not have possibly known what the last 2 years, what it was going to be like and how much the world was going to need our little offering. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, you know, there's my biggest conflict with being an actor or being a part of this industry is sometimes like, I fear that what we do is not enough, or that how is it possible when there's a war, when there's climate disaster, not even crisis, constant climate disaster, everything is, it feels like it's crumbling. How is art going to help it? Mm-hmm. And I feel like the release of this film and witnessing how people are responding to it is giving me some sort of full circle healing, because I think the movie's stance is like, yeah, there are a million other universes that we could be in. There are a lot of possibilities if we went right instead of left that one time. But there's a lot that we don't know. And, you know, in some ways, I think I am someone who's constantly searching for meaning. But when I was working on this project, I would say that nihilism in some ways saved my life, because if nothing matters, then it's true that we're all just trying to figure it out together.
And that's, in a way, I mean, that's your character, Joy. That's her journey, right? It's from starting off at a point where it feels like nothing matters, from nothing matters to it all matters.
I think what I love about Joy, this, you know, sort of despondent queer daughter, and Jobu, a nihilistic, you know, creator of chaos goddess and maniac, is that actually something that was really important for all of us was to make sure that the center of their beings, these two characters, were actually from the same heartbeat.
Right.
So that spirit of nihilism, you know, can either pull you off the deep end and make you feel like there's no reason to continue, or it can like, you know, slingshot you into the other direction, which is, I will just create as much chaos as possible because none of this matters.
For you playing these two very different characters, was there anything you reached for physically or in terms of your inner process when you were switching back and forth? What did you reach for when you needed to feel that continuity between them?
I sort of think of both Joy and Jobu as hyper, hyper empaths. I think the most important thing that I felt like I needed to share with the two characters was this really real feeling, I mean, from my own life, of just overwhelm, of, I mean, it's feeling the world, like the absolute weight of not only this universe, but all the universes that come before, and then imagining what future lies ahead. Just really tapping into that. And then for Joy, you know, obviously she's a much more intimate character, and getting to play in that sort of physical manifestation of sadness or like ugliness or just wanting to be small. Versus Jobu, we did a lot of improvisation, and because she's kind of a omniscient being and not quite human, I was really channeling a lot of like amoeba / noodle energy of like, yeah. If Jobu was a cartoon, she'd be able to like and explode into a particle, or then explode into a basketball player, you know, and trying to embody that availability in her physicality.
You know, it's funny. I was going to say, it's like very telling that at first when Joy comes on screen, I had no idea that she was depressed. I was like, that's on me. I was like, oh, this is just a realistic depiction of what it's like to be a daughter of immigrants who's living in a different world than her parents. And then it like halfway through, I was like, oh,
yeah.
Oh, she's not well.
Yeah.
And I was like, I am
not well.
But I think I had read other interviews with you when you were saying that knowing that you would get to be, you know, this amoeba bursting with chaos allowed you to just root into that weight and the like the mire that Joy is so stuck in.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, to this day, it's one of the best scripts that I've ever read. But it's so rare that you get to see a character that just is asking you to show so much range, and not even show range from an egotistical standpoint, but that like one person who is so sad in one world suddenly, you know, is wearing these extraordinary costumes and is so powerful in every other world. And So I really wanted to stretch both realities mm-hmm. as far as I could.
This movie really felt like a landmark for me because of the exact way that it foregrounded and centered an Asian immigrant story, because the movie not just mirrors, but really actively explores the way that the particularities of identity feel to me. And you've talked in another interview about how you thought the film, in a way, transcended identity politics. And I wondered if you had any more thoughts on that subject.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that there's such amazing movement that's happening in terms of visibility. I just watched Turning Red, the new Pixar movie, and just cried like the whole time. If I had seen that when I was a kid, mm-hmm. my entire life, my own inner red panda of this thing that I now do with my career, I think I would have unleashed it much sooner. Yeah. And so I think, you know, but it's also what I love about that movie and our movie is that it's reaching so many people outside of just the AAPI community. I just think that beyond, it is so crucial to have conversations and specific conversations about how individuals or different cultures grow up or grow in society. And I find that sometimes our conversations that we're having right now are both incredibly helpful and at its worst are really alienating.
Like re-essentializing and identity, where the whole point
exactly,
is
it's to, re-essentializing yeah. is totally the perfect word for that. And that brings me, that is not the ideal society that right. I'm looking for, right? Like we need, so many conversations need to be had in order for us to move through into this next version that is more nuanced and complex. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely not negating where we are at. But I agree. I think I'm looking forward to continue to like broaden our horizons so much that, you know, 5-10 years from now, identity isn't something that we're using as a flex and more of just a part of a texture of a story mm-hmm. that is crucial and critical, but also not the only fruit that mm-hmm. piece bears.
Yeah. I was so, you know, for all of the complexity in the million universes, right, the movie really centers on something very intimate, which is this intergenerational conveyance or non-conveyance of care and love, and specifically the relationship between a mother and a daughter. And I was so, you know, I was so moved. Michelle Yeoh is my mom's age. I was so moved by the centering of a suburban Asian mom in her sneakers and her bootcut weekday pants as this, you know, universe-saving hero. Like that felt so wonderful to me.
We're listening to Gia Tolentino in conversation with Stephanie Hsu, one of the stars of Everything Everywhere All at Once. Michelle Yeoh plays Evelyn, who's the hero and the mother of Hsu's character.
I wanted to ask you, could I ask you about your mom's reaction to the movie? Have you watched it with her?
Yeah, totally. So my mom, she came to the LA premiere and she definitely wasn't like a huge advocate for me when I was growing up to be an actor. She was very puzzled by that choice or that pursuit. But she saw the movie, and after I asked her, she was kind of quiet, and I asked her, you know, did you like it? And she's like, she just nodded behind her mask, and she's like, yes. And then she pointed to the movie screen, and she goes, I cried. That's me. And it's really wild because of course, because I was playing Joy and Jobu, so much of my entry point was from the point of view of a daughter, mm-hmm. but you know, I really like hearing her say that, not even her saying that's you, but her saying that's me made me feel that the movie also offered her healing too, of not only her relationship with me, but also her relationship with her parents. Because we have Gong Gong in the picture, you know, we have the grandfather in the picture, and it was really special. I still reflect, I'm still chewing over that interaction with her, because I've been hearing a lot of people saying that they watch the movie, or they send their parents to watch the movie, and then their parents call them and apologize.
Yeah.
And I just think that is such a, you know, this movie, I'm proud of it for so many reasons, but the biggest gift has been that I very palpably feel that it is offering people healing. Mm-hmm. And that is all I could ever wish for any piece of art that I put out into the world.
Yeah.
And it's helpful to remember that art is capable of doing that, you know, yeah, to moving us into action.
Okay, just a couple more questions for you. Just to
I heard that I was allowed to ask you questions.
Ask me whatever you want.
Well, I want to say that I'm just such a huge fan of yours.
Oh my God.
And but I had never known that you were Filipina.
Oh.
And I had never known that you were AAPI until this interview was set up. And I looked up a photo of you and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so crazy.
It's that, and it's that colonizer last name I've got.
It's the Tolentino.
It's the Tolentino.
You're like, oh, she's an Italian mobster writing for The New Yorker. but I was curious, you know, in all our conversations around race and how it's presented in popular culture. And I'm curious as to how your experience of it as a journalist is, and yeah, how that plays into the stories you tell or the walls that you feel like you have to push mm-hmm. through or walk past.
That is, I wasn't expecting to answer a question, but you know, it's,
sorry.
It's I feel, you know, I was thinking about this when we were talking about the wanting to avoid the trap of re-essentializing identity, because I feel like the whole point of valuing the particularities of anyone's identity is to not to enshrine them in stone, but to move towards a world where everything is, everyone's identity is crucially important, but also like you understand identity is fundamentally fluid and fundamentally kind of incidental. And like, and I think about when I was writing my book, I think one of the things I thought about was the way that, let's say, like white male culture writers had always written criticism or whatever and assumed their perspective to be the universal default. I was like, I want to do that too. I want to write a kind of mainstream book about culture from the implicit point of view of me as a Filipino woman that grew up in Texas and have that be kind of as naturally a default perspective for cultural criticism, the way that we've been presented with like the white perspective as the natural default for any perspective in anything else, right? But I think I just feel really conscious of the moment that we're in. We have just more freedom than anyone ever did, at you know, anyone in our identity position ever has had, maybe historically, right? And it feels like a complicated thrill to be able to see how we're all going to use it, you know, and see how we're all going to be able to work to whatever vision of freedom that we're looking for, right?
Totally. I love that. And I think part of what made me so excited to know that I had loved your work before I even knew what you looked like was that it was your voice, your writing, your implicit, like the implicit normalcy and expansiveness of your thoughts articulated and not the color of your skin that made me drawn to you. And so I think what you were saying earlier about, I feel like I'm in this moment where I'm able to be here because of so much of the space that other people have made for me. And simultaneously, I'm also co-creating for those who come after me. I really feel like right straddling that line, because when I first started, there was no Crazy Rich Asians, there was no Parasite, there was no Turning Red or Everything Everywhere, right? And I think that this movie and how it's been received is giving me permission, like really deep permission for the first time in my life to really love this thing that I do, because I'm not a doctor. I don't have the skill sets or the gifts that I've been given are in this little corner of the world. And it is not, it is immense, actually. There's great responsibility in being a person who shifts culture. And so if that is the toolbox I've been given, then I better use it wisely and hold it with grace and enjoy it and celebrate it.
Stephanie Hsu is one of the stars of Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, and it's in theaters now. You can read Gia Tolentino at newyorker.com. More to come, so please stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has brought about devastating violence and destruction. It's displaced an estimated 10 million civilians, Ukrainian citizens, immigrants, and visitors to the country. Staff writer Alexis Okeowo has covered conflict and human rights issues around the world. To someone familiar with the plight of refugees, what's happening now around Ukraine seems both familiar and startlingly different. Alexis Okeowo spoke with one of our producers, Gofen Mputubwele. Here's Gofen.
So we're going to start back in 2017. Two men detonated two truck bombs in the capital of Somalia, Mogadishu. Around 2,000 pounds of explosives went off. At the time, Alexis Okeo was living in the States, but they were doing a lot of reporting related to the continent.
It was interesting. I was on social media, and it felt like I was in two parallel realities. And one, you know, a lot of my American friends, colleagues, et cetera, were talking about other news. And then in the other one, my Somali friends and colleagues, East African friends and colleagues, were all talking about the recent attack. And, you know, I had that thought, why doesn't anyone seem to care about this? And I mean anyone specifically in the United States where I live and work.
The explosives went off on a Saturday afternoon in a busy intersection, blowing out at least 512 lives. The most lethal terrorist attack that Somalia has ever experienced. And yet, over here in the States, the news didn't make much of a splash, barely even a ripple. Here's what Alexis wrote at the time. What is often missing in the days following attacks in Somalia are the intimate stories about the victims.
The sense that real, breathing people were affected, and that these catastrophes are neither normal nor expected. With a place like Somalia, defined by stereotypes beyond its borders, it has become acceptable to think of the country as holding only war and extremism, and to forget that the lives there are multi-layered, possessing similar and universal concerns, interests, and desires. I think that in that piece, I was trying to think about, you know, what does it mean when a place is written about and covered in a certain way for years, for decades? And so things like that insanely begin to be seen as routine there, even though for the people who live there, who experience it, it's nothing like routine. It's devastating. And then how do you as a journalist try to convey that to people who live very far away and who, again, hold these stereotypes of this place in their head?
All of this came to mind for me when Russia invaded Ukraine in February. It was as if a trigger went off, like someone flipped an empathy switch for us as a society to pour out support for Ukraine. Within 24 to 48 hours, just watching the news, I absorbed hundreds of years of Eastern European history. I knew the colors of the Ukrainian flag almost immediately, and images of grieving victims saturated news coverage. And for context here, I'm the child of a country, the Democratic Republic of Congo, that's been at war for at least 20 years, bleeding refugees, child soldiers. In graduate school and then in law school, that's what I focused on. How conflict displaces people and how conflict intersects with international criminal law. But as someone whose job it is now to craft stories as a journalist, since the war started, I can't pull my eyes away from the stories we tell about Ukraine and how we formulate them, the characters we select, the verbs we use, and how that varies from other parts of the world I know. Frankly, where I would live, if it hadn't been for me, by the luck of the draw, being born while my parents were here and not there. So I called Alexis. We started by talking about a piece Alexis published right after Russia's invasion, about how Ukrainian refugees were being received.
I remember I was on a plane to Europe, and I just felt the impulse to write this so keenly because I was on my way to start reporting a piece about migration, but about very different kind of migrants. I was reporting about refugees from Africa and the Middle East who were being ignored and facing a lot of difficulties because they were encountering a lot of hostility and rejection from many places in Europe that they were trying to flee to. And then to look at the news and see how Ukrainian refugees were being received so warmly, it was mind-boggling to me. It was this strange feeling. And then not only reading that, but then to see that Black people, brown people who are also trying to flee Ukraine were also facing the same kind of discrimination I was seeing that refugees from Black and brown countries were. You know, it was, I felt very upset about it. And I felt like, you know, it's something we needed to point out.
When you say they were being received warmly, like the Ukrainian refugees, what does that look like? And how does that compare to how you've seen other refugees treated?
When Ukrainian refugees first started leaving their country, and up until now, neighboring countries, other nations in Europe immediately expressed the sentiment that they wanted to take them in, they wanted to help, they wanted to assist them. Germany and Austria began offering free train rides to Ukrainian refugees who wanted to come in. The European Union enacted a temporary protection directive, which gave citizens and permanent residents of Ukraine residency for at least 1 year, which allowed them more time to go through the asylum process and to have a place to live and access social services. But on the other hand, Italy and other countries in Europe have been prosecuting people who they've accused of helping migrants from other countries. The Prime Minister of Hungary has said that he wants to, he's built a border fence to keep out what he calls Muslim invaders. you know, last year, refugees were trying to cross Poland's border with Belarus, and they were pushed back by security forces with tear gas and water cannons in the freezing cold.
Mm.
And so I think the question then becomes why? You know, there are reasons that seem pretty obvious, racism, Islamophobia, but then that can't explain it all, right? I mean, I think as you said to me, you don't doubt that people want to help. It's just, you know, a matter of why certain people are being seen as worthy of help and others aren't.
Right, right, right. I've felt a sort of conflict where I'm like, both, yes, this is something that we should care about, but also at the same time, why am I being steered to care about this, if that makes sense?
Yeah, yeah. And what are your theories as to why?
My theories? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like, I think I have the same inclination where I'm like, well, racism seems like a thing. But I think the other thing that's jumped out to me is a sort of, it's not that we say that, like, a war in Congo, where my family is from, doesn't matter. But more, we have this idea that a war in some of these other countries is normal. You look at black and brown people and you kind of say, well, these people are used to this. Or like, this is what it's like where they're from. The sad reality is just like, you know, some parts of the world, like, we just can't fix it.
Right.
But it's almost like the racism comes out in a sort of, it shouldn't be this way in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
The hardworking people in Ukraine don't deserve this. It's like a full humanity given to them versus a sort of partial humanity, if that, to non-white folks.
Well, I think what you just described is the definition of racism.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's who is given humanity? And going back to media coverage, and I think the role of any journalist, especially journalists who are reporting on places or communities that aren't their own, is to try to portray your subjects with as much humanity as you can. But because that hasn't always been the case, especially with the places we're talking about, who are supplying most of the world's refugees right now, I think that's part of the cause of the problem we're in right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems, to me, it feels like we have a really sort of anemic politics of care. And I'm kind of two minds about this, because I do think it's true that people can only handle so much conflict before they shut down. I think that that's true as a general statement. I know that it is true in my own life. When it comes to things in Congo in particular, I only have a certain threshold before I have to be like, I just have to put this, jettison this. Otherwise, I will not function. So I think that's real. But I also wonder if there are ways that we can make our ideas of who we care about more robust. I think a thing that I struggled with at some point in the Ukraine coverage was I almost felt like people were like, oh yeah, the coverage is racist. Oh, we're racist. We're racist again. And I'm like, yeah, we are, but like, can we do something? Like, is there a way to reframe like our behavior or our discussion so that like that reality changes and not just sort of a mea culpa, like, oh, look, America's racist again. I'm like, be better. You know?
Is there like something you can see in your head? Like, if we got to that next step, what would it look like?
One of the ways that I feel like our storytelling in journalism, or like communication of stories about places like Africa or Latin America or the Middle East, sort of diminishes people's humanity is by not affording them full agency. And I think that that happens through the actual language that we use, like the actual craft of putting our sentences together. So it's the difference between like saying a bomb went off, there was a bombing, there was a terrorist attack, instead of two people detonated a bomb. Or, you know, like that sort of more active role, which I think gives people motives and agency, and like already you're more interested.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think part of that is because when you do frame the headline like that, so-and-so did this, then you have to explain why. And I think for a variety of reasons, laziness, resources, lack of interest, perhaps, that why part has influenced why we don't see headlines that are phrased that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally, totally. I think that immediately you have a why, and then I think a lot of us realize that the why, especially with a terrorist attack, gets pretty complex. And so it's like, are we going to talk about what led to the condition so that someone found themselves in this, you know? So, Alexis, you asked me if there was a future I could see in my head, like that next step in media coverage, say. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that. Like, what would that alternate universe look like to you?
I agree with you. I think it would look like a place where we're receiving stories from all corners of the world, not just told by Westerners too. I mean, told by people from those places that are nuanced and enriching and complex, and that we're seeing on the homepages that we visit every day and we're seeing in our feeds. So while on the one hand we're hearing all about Ukraine, we're also hearing all about Ethiopia, we're also hearing about the Congo, and there doesn't feel like such a huge difference.
That was staff writer Alexis Okeowo speaking with producer Gofan Emputobwele. And that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.